This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 31st. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Eight more Palestinians killed in Mideast violence, further dimming prospects for peace in the region. The UN claims a crop spraying campaign in Colombia, funded by the U.S., is hurting the poor. And public radio listeners in New York rally over the firing of a popular reporter at WBAI, the latest on Pacifica Network in turmoil. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. There's been an attempted military coup in Haiti. Kevin Pina reports from Port-au-Prince.
At 4 a.m., we heard lots of rounds of gunfire, automatic weapons fire. We weren't exactly sure what was going on. What we found out is that there was an attempted coup by members of the former military. It was a coordinated attack that happened throughout the entire country in all nine departments. They captured the police headquarters in Pétionville. They emptied the facility of arms, and they took several members of the police force captive, hostage. At the same time, CIMO and the SWAT team responded. They surrounded the palace. At the same time, Route Frere, where there's a National Police Academy, was attacked as well. The head of the National Police Academy, I don't have his name right now, was killed. There have been two other police officers killed.
That was Kevin Pina reporting from Haiti, courtesy of KPFA's Flashpoints program. Pina adds that though the coup has been put down, a hostile military may still topple the government of democratically elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Some 500 Mexican rebel sympathizers blocked roads in the southern state of Chiapas on Monday to protest against a recently ratified indigenous rights law they say fails to protect Indians. John Ross is in Mexico.
This is probably one of the first instances of organized protest against or asking the president, Vicente Fox, to veto this very controversial Indian rights bill. Based on an agreement that was reached between the Zapatistas and the government, but then essentially gutted by Congress. It has been passed by Congress, and it's been ratified by 17 states. And despite the protests of indigenous people all over the country, and despite the fact that 80% of the indigenous population concentrated in states that rejected the bill itself, The original agreement and the original law that was written from the agreement provided for indigenous autonomy, meaning that they would be able to control and run their own affairs, their own exploitation of natural resources and control of agricultural lands as well. All that has been taken out of the bill. In many respects, the indigenous rights bill has been turned against the Indians themselves and has allowed the local congresses rather than the federal congress to control when indigenous people are able to run their own affairs.
While a majority of Mexican states approved the reformed indigenous rights bill, activists say opposition from Indian communities should be enough to render reforms illegitimate and prompt the federal government to consider new, further-reaching guarantees of Indian rights. Louis Farrakhan, the head of the Nation of Islam, has won a long legal battle against the British government after a court judgment overturned a 15-year ban which prohibited him from visiting the UK. Vivian Schweitzer reports from London.
Government lawyers argued the ban was justified because of inflammatory remarks previously made by Mr. Farrakhan against Jews and Israel. Lord Janner, chairman of the Holocaust Educational Trust, said, "This is a sad day for us all in Britain who work for good race relations. And I'm especially concerned that we continue to keep the excellent relations between the Jewish and Muslim communities of the UK." However, Hilary Mohammed, the UK spokesman for the Nation of Islam, welcomed the judge's ruling, saying that British citizens will have a chance to see, hear, and judge the Honourable Minister Louis Farrakhan for themselves. There are no immediate plans for Mr. Farrakhan to visit the UK, and the Home Secretary may appeal against the ruling. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Vivian Schweitzer in London.
After spending 14 years and $4.5 billion to figure out whether Yucca Mountain is dry and stable enough to entomb highly radioactive waste for some 10,000 years, the Department of Energy is shifting its focus from geology to the protective powers of titanium and steel. Bob Lux is the director of Nevada's Nuclear Waste Project Office.
The Department of Energy now is in agreement with the state that Yucca Mountain really is a poor place for isolating waste, and the only way they can quote, make it work, unquote, is by having beefed up extraordinarily large metal containers that they believe will last for tens of thousands of years. So we're relying now on metal containers rather than geology for waste isolation.
As the Energy Department moves nearer to advising President Bush this year on whether to proceed with seeking a license for the site, the engineered portion of the design is dominating the discussion. This spring, the department issued a report that said containers could be counted on to hold up for at least 11,000 years after the site was sealed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
At least 8 Palestinians, including a senior Hamas official, were killed today in what witnesses described as an Israeli attack on an office of the militant Islamic group in the West Bank. Witnesses at the scene in the Palestinian-ruled city of Nablus gave conflicting accounts of what caused the explosion. Some told reporters that missiles fired from an Israeli aircraft hit the office, but others said Israeli troops may have fired from tanks or combat helicopters. 2 children were among the victims. Yesterday, 6 Palestinians were killed by an explosion in a refugee village outside of Nablus. That explosion came on the heels of clashes Sunday between Israeli police and Muslims who were throwing rocks at Jews praying at the wall of a highly disputed religious site. Muslims were reacting to Jewish attempts to lay a cornerstone for a future temple at a site both Jews and Muslims consider holy land. Muslims viewed the cornerstone laying as a desecration of the religious dwelling. One thing is certain, the so-called U.S. brokered peace process is disintegrating. Peretz Kedron is a Free Speech Radio News correspondent living in Jerusalem. He says the violence is beginning to escalate as the peace process remains on a downward spiral.
Well, many of the attacks are the sort of tit-for-tat revenge for the previous attack, each side trying to exact retribution for its own losses and its own casualties, each side claiming to act in self-defense, and each side effectively seeing no other way out because the kind of political contacts, the diplomatic contacts that could be a substitute for the violence and put an end to the violence, these contacts are effectively dead because the Israeli government refuses to talk as long as there's any show of Palestinian resistance. And the Palestinian leadership, sees no reason why it should fall out with its own hardliners for the sake of political talks which promise the Palestinians very little, very much less than they were promised by the previous government. So each side is more or less set on its present course, and the present course is a spiral of violence that's getting worse by the day.
Kidron fears the U.S. brokered peace deal worked out by U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell is far too soft to be successful. He believes both sides need to be bullied into ending this decades-old conflict.
Well, in that sense, Colin Powell repeated the mistake that was made by President Clinton, who thought that smiling at everybody in sight was some way of bringing out peace, and he doesn't realize that the only role that the United States has in this region is that being the most powerful element, potentially, it has to look stern and threaten and wave a big stick about in order to get the sides to stop the violence. Just smiling and making helpful suggestions is no good at all. The only way the leaders on either side, and in this sense Sharon and Arafat are in the same situation, the only way the leaders on either side will order their forces to stop shooting will be if they come under very obvious, very clear, very public threat from the United States that this is too much and this is threatening U.S. interests, and therefore the United States is going to intervene, and not intervene by nice-talking either side, but with some blunt words and ultimatum to put an end to the force and to sit down and talk.
Kidron suggests a much more forceful position, similar to the one taken by former President Bush. Meanwhile, Kidron is reading signs of a revitalizing peace movement in Jerusalem, in spite of an overall climate supporting the violence. A recent news poll shows 70% of Israelis believe Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is being too weak with the Palestinians. But Kidron points to a recent court proceeding on the international scene that may be reshaping Israeli public opinion.
There's always been a peace movement, but the sort of softer elements fell apart after the Barak government, and it's only left the hardcore. And it didn't look very dramatic at first because it's relatively small groups, but things are happening. And also another thing that's happening is that there's genuine alarm over the court case in Belgium against Ariel Sharon, and that the Israeli ambassador to Denmark, who's a former head of the security police, looks like getting a very unfriendly reception because he was in charge of an organization that used torture. And the Israeli public opinion is suddenly waking up to the fact that many of the things that are done in its name by the security services and by the army are considered war crimes, and that therefore a considerable chunk of the national leadership could theoretically find itself sitting alongside Milosevic. And that is that's quite a shock here, and there's a lot of anger and bewilderment and dismay, because after all, Israel and the Jewish people were quite pioneers in the concept of demanding international justice against war crimes.
Peretz Gedron is a freelance reporter living and working in Jerusalem. The former head of South Africa's chemical and biological warfare has testified that apartheid-era authorities gave him unlimited power to further its secret mission. Dr. Wouter Besson, dubbed Dr. Death by the media, has been on trial for 21 months, accused of some of the most horrific crimes committed in the name of apartheid, including 13 counts of murder. Besson, who has pleaded innocent, told the court he had the authority to tell foreign enemies about South African secrets as long as he received more information than he gave. He said he could spend money as he saw fit and travel to wherever he wanted. More from Naeem Jinnah in Johannesburg.
As apartheid South Africa's chemical and biological warfare program comes under scrutiny at the Pretoria High Court trial of its former head, South Africans wonder how much more there might be to uncover. Dr. Wouter Besson is facing 46 charges ranging from drug trafficking to murder. Besson, who headed the program under its codename Project Coast, is unrepentant for his crimes and even somewhat proud of the nickname the South African media have given him, Dr. Death.
The term Dr. Death was originally coined in the press. I see it and there's nothing I can do about it. It's a perception that some people have. I must admit the majority of my patients, or most of the patients, are not bothered at all. They want to have good medical treatment, they want to be cured, and they're happy. I've had no complaints, and I've had no patient turn around and walk away when they find out who I am.
Project Coast was initiated in the early 1980s by General Niels Knobel. Paradoxically, Knobel now belongs to the South African Council for the Non-Proliferation of Weapons of Mass Destruction. In 1983, Besson was made head of the South African Defense Forces Rudi Plaat Research Laboratories. According to testimony before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, his team studied the use of illegal drugs to assist them in the fight against the anti-apartheid movement. Shafinaz Hassam, researcher at the University of the Witwatersrand, described some of the activities of Project Coast.
They developed strains of anthrax, which they'd already tested in Rhodesia in the 70s. We worked with hepatitis A and with cholera, which was let out into the water sources in the townships. They developed assassination tools.
The Rudi Plaat Research Laboratories were disbanded in 1993, a little before South Africa's first democratic election, and Knobel ordered the destruction of all documents. Besson held on to them. In 1997, he was arrested in possession of 1,000 ecstasy tablets. His trial began in October 1999 and is expected to last 3 years. Only in February this year was he dismissed from his cardiologist position at the Pretoria Academic Hospital. According to the TRC, developing South Africa's chemical and biological warfare program would not have been possible without international cooperation and support. Besson had visited Taiwan, where he was shown CBW facilities and provided with information, and attended a conference at San Antonio in the United States in the early 1980s. There were also links between the CBW Surgeon General and American agencies, with the latter having expressed a willingness to assist the South African program. Along with the use of fertility drugs, anthrax in cigarettes, botulinum in milk, paraoxin in whiskey, and poisoning of black townships' water supplies with cholera, Besson also allegedly drew up plans to distribute T-shirts poisoned with euphoria-producing drugs in black townships, and planned to supply poisoned beer for tests on unsuspecting black taxi drivers. Further, a bacteriologist has testified that he had freeze-dried HIV-infected blood to be used by apartheid operatives as part of Besson's program. Assassinations of anti-apartheid activists was part of the activities of Besson's group. One of the victims who managed to escape death was then Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches, Reverend Frank Chikane. His clothes had been poisoned.
I think there are many people out there who did quite some awful things in this country who have not had the courage to stand up and say, we did it and we are sorry about it. And I'm still hoping that they will.
Besson said he was given unlimited power by the apartheid authorities to further his work. While Besson's legal team seems convinced their client will be acquitted, South Africans will live with his legacy for a long time. The drugs distributed to destabilize black townships, the gangs set up to distribute these, and the lawlessness created by them to this day are just some of these effects. Also, while Dr. Death was undoubtedly one of the most cruel operatives in South Africa's army, it seems that those higher up in the apartheid machinery will not face trial for their role in the development of these weapons. And who knows what the HIV-infected blood was used for. This is Naeem Jina in Johannesburg for Free Speech Radio News.
Residents of a tiny Pacific Island nation will not be able to flee to Australia when global warming floods them out of their homes. Australian authorities this month turned down Tuvalu's plea for shelter for its 11,000 people as rising sea levels threaten to engulf their homes. The Tuvaluan government hopes to resettle its entire population before the nation's 9 low-lying coral atolls become uninhabitable, which could be in just 50 years. Tuvaluans say their country is steadily disappearing as the earth warms and the seas rise. More from Kathy Keeney in Melbourne.
For us in Tuvalu, the issue is no longer the question of whether the sea level is rising or not, but rather the rate at which it is coming.
Panilu Pepper, acting secretary of the Tuvalu's Ministry of Natural Resources, providing a concrete example of the impact of global warming. Tuvalu is a small archipelago in the Pacific Ocean. Its highest point is just 3 to 4 metres above sea level. The imminent threat of rising sea levels has forced the Tuvalu government to take drastic action.
The government has taken a long-term approach, what we call the precautionary approach, in that we've asked Australia and New Zealand if they could provide some sort of homeland for us in the likely event that the whole population has to be relocated in 50, 60 years' time. So we have asked Australia and New Zealand, because if we become environmental refugees, then obviously we have to be relocated somewhere else, especially when Tuvalu is just, on average, just 2 metres above sea level.
While New Zealand seems open to discussion, the Australian government response has not been favourable. Panilu Pepper continues.
It was a blunt, very blunt no. When our delegation came to Australia and they asked them, you know, before they even mentioned it, they already say no. And I also read in the paper your immigration minister's response to that, saying that we should apply under normal immigration formalities. But for us, you know, this is not a normal immigration sort of a thing. You know, it has to be considered separately from the normal rules that apply under immigration, normal immigration quota. Because this is not immigration, you know, this is relocation. People are being relocated because of the actions that were not ours in the first place, our doing in the first place. And that part of the problem is the Australian people themselves, they're contributing to this global warming.
Tristy Fairfield, climate change spokesperson for Friends of the Earth Australia, agrees that the Australian people need to shoulder some responsibility.
We've actually got the worst per capita rate of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. So when you compare us to countries like China and India, the developing countries, we produce at least 10, you know, sometimes 16 times more greenhouse gas emissions per person per year. So we are really, you know, the worst in the world. And in terms of regional concepts, the Pacific Island nations are the ones that are really suffering from climate change right now, and that's in terms of coral bleaching, rising sea levels, impacts on fisheries. So in a regional sense, we really are letting down our neighbours and not playing the role of a good global citizen.
Australia's behaviour at the climate change negotiations in Bonn was typical of its obstructive attitude to climate change.
Australia's behaviour at these international negotiations has been absolutely abysmal. There's no doubt about it. They played a wrecking role in The Hague, and they certainly continued that at Bonn, despite them saying that they would play a constructive role. The Australian government, prior to going to Bonn, had said they had no intention of ratifying this agreement without the United States, and all they really did there was hold up negotiations, introduce new text to things that had been agreed to, try and wear out the negotiators who are already very weary and tired. They really played an obstructive, wrecking role in these negotiations, and it's certainly nothing to be proud of.
For the people of Tuvalu who face exile, actions such as these are devastating. Pani Lupepa has these final words for the international community.
They should take some form of responsibility for the actions that they are causing to the atmosphere, which down the road is affecting the people of Tuvalu most severely, and not people in Australia or in other industrialized nations.
And that's Kathy Keeney reporting from Melbourne. A U.S. crop dusting campaign in Colombia, supposedly targeted at industrial plantations, is coming under criticism by the U.N. for harming smaller fields and damaging the health of Colombia's indigenous people. With more on the story, Susan Wood reports.
Klaus Niehom, director of the United Nations International Drug Control Program in Colombia, says the U.S.-funded aerial spray campaign is hurting the poor. Contrary to the Colombian government's assertion that it targets only industrial-sized plantations, he says small coca and poppy fields are also being fumigated, destroying legal crops along with illicit ones.
The UN, the UNDCP in particular, is very much against fumigations of small farmers and indigenous people. We believe that if fumigation should go on, well, they should be done environmentally safe and health-wise safe, but it should be concentrated on the big plantations of coca and opium poppy.
At a news conference last week, Niehom called for international monitors, together with UNDCP and the World Health Organization, to document the effects of spraying on the ground and have the power to investigate complaints. Farmers, environmentalists, and human rights advocates have long contended that glyphosate, the fumigation chemical of choice, makes people and animals sick and damages the environment. Niehom is skeptical of these claims and says unbiased studies are needed. And while the UN supports alternative development programs that would subsidize farmers to replace coca with coffee, the head of the Drug Enforcement Agency says fumigation is also needed.
When you deal with the cartels, with the big coca growers, with those who run the big cocaine laboratories, I mean, they cannot be won over by development, that we know. So there, it's law enforcement, and we actually assist the Colombian government and the other governments in the region in this.
But if the goal is to curtail the flow of illegal drugs, the strategy isn't working, according to Ricardo Vargas. A sociologist, Vargas is a member of Acción Andina, a group of scientists and scholars working on alternatives to the war on drugs in the Andean region. Studies produced by the group show that coca production capacity in the region declined by only 5% during the 1990s, despite defoliation on a scale not seen since the Vietnam War. Vargas says Colombian studies show similar results. From 1994 to 1998, the department in which most of the production took place was Guaviare, in the Amazon region, he says. And for 4 years, that's where fumigation efforts were concentrated. The result, he says, was that cultivation shifted to Putumayo and other areas. Indeed, coca production is increasing. A recent UN study using satellite data showed there were 402,000 acres of coca in all of Colombia as of late last year, well above earlier estimates of about 340,000 acres. The reason, according to Ricardo Vargas, is that Colombia's 38-year-old civil war is fueled by drug profits. Both the anti-government Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and the right-wing paramilitaries linked, according to human rights activists, to the Colombian army and police, sell cocaine and heroin to buy weapons. The problem won't be solved at the first link in the chain, he says. It won't be solved by going after illicit crops. This policy, he says, isn't hurting the drug traffickers. It's only hurting farmers, indigenous people, and the poor. Vargas says the only way to break the power of the narco-traffickers is for governments to cooperate in tracing and confiscating the laundered drug money he says is tightly bound up with the legal economy of many states. He also supports manual eradication, but says it can only succeed if there is a peaceful solution to the armed conflict and local communities are involved in development efforts. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Last night, over 100 listeners rallied in front of New York Pacifica radio station WBAI to protest last week's termination of award-winning WBAI programmer Robert Knight. Knight's dismissal from the station brings the list of the fired and banned from WBAI to over 20 since December's so-called Christmas coup, when former programmer Utrice Lead was installed as station manager. Miranda Kennedy reports from New York.
Your program, Earthwatch, is canceled. I am no longer a host of this program or any other program at this time. I may not co-host, substitute as host, produce for, contribute for, or do anything for any other program on WBAI at this time. I can't even listen.
WBAI producer Robert Knight received this memo from WBAI station manager Utrice Lead 1 minute before he was to go on the air with his regularly scheduled late-night program Earthwatch. But Earthwatch, which he has hosted for 24 years, did not air last Thursday. Knight won the prestigious George F. Polk Award for his coverage of the 1989 U.S. invasion of Panama. He made his name at WBAI as news director and as co-host of the nationally syndicated morning program ContraGate about the Reagan-era scandals in Central America. In February, management removed Knight from his position as news anchor for WBAI's popular wake-up call morning show, but he continued to report several times a week for the station's evening news. According to Leeds' memo, he is now suspended from producing for the news until August 15th, and his show has been canceled altogether.
BAI is a lot like City Hall. You've got a period of executive vandalism taking place in both arenas, with leaders dedicated to destroying everything that there is of the culture that they temporarily inherited, and who spend their time trying to remove people from the community that they temporarily control.
There appeared to be no immediate catalyst for action taken against Knight, although he has steadily covered the struggle over the future of Pacifica Radio on Earthwatch. There is an inconsistently enforced gag rule on discussion of internal station matters on the airways of WBAI. Lead's memo listed Knight's inadequate and undisciplined preparation and frantic scurrying around as reasons for the termination of his show. At the rally yesterday, fired wake-up call producer Janice K. Bryant noted that of those fired and banned from WBAI, most have been people of color, community activists, and the most political programmers at the station.
One thing that we've been hearing a lot of from the beginning is that this is not a revolt down here of the real people. We have maintained from the beginning that the communities that will be hit the hardest by this coup will be communities of color.
Many of the 22 producers and volunteers who no longer work at WBAI were the station's leading producers of color. Listeners and producers outside the station yesterday demanded the return of all the fired and banned, the end of management intrusion into regularly scheduled programs, and to stop video surveillance inside the community station. Calls to Utrice Lead were not returned. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown.